Now, obviously last week, on last Thursday, I spoke about very difficult questions in the philosophy of mind and metaphysics about the first person case and the meaning of the word I, and the way in which that word and the concept contained in it penetrates our experience as self-conscious beings and transforms that experience beyond anything that is known elsewhere in the animal kingdom. And that, I think, is a very important starting point for any theology worth the name. But today I'm going to talk, concentrating on the face, and I'm beginning today from the face of the person, namely what we all know from each other. Now, the lamentation in the 13th Psalm is expressed thus: "How long wilt thou forget me, O Lord? Forever? How long wilt thou hide thy face from me?" In Psalm 17, we read, "As for me, I will behold thy face in righteousness. I shall be satisfied when I awake with thy likeness." The fourth psalm implores God to lift up the light of your countenance upon us. So if you think of these three quotations, you can see that we have moved a long way from the Torah, in which it was said that no man shall look on my face and live. The hope of a face-to-face encounter fills the Psalms from beginning to end, and the hope is turned to a promise by the Apostle Paul, who tells us that now we see through a glass darkly, but then face-to-face. God's face, which Moses was forbidden to see, is now at the center of faith and hope, and the way to it, Paul says, is agape, the New Testament word for neighbor love, translated as caritas in the Vulgate, and described by Kant as the love to which we are commanded. So what is meant by the face of God? This will be the theme of my remaining lectures, and the obvious starting point, given the argument of the last lecture, is the human face. What is it exactly? What role does it play in interpersonal relations, and what is its fate in the age in which we live? The theme of the face is familiar from a certain kind of continental philosophy, and Immanuel Levinas has devoted pages of tantalizing obscurity to expounding it. The face, writes Levinas, is in and of itself visitation and transcendence. And by this he seems to mean that the face comes into our shared world from a place beyond it, while in some way remaining beyond it, transcendent, always just out of reach. And that is the thought which I wish to explore. And I want to bring this all-important topic within the purview of philosophy as we know it in the English-speaking world, namely philosophy as argument, whose goal is both clarity and truth. Levinas belongs to another tradition, the tradition of the prophets and mystics, who pursue dark thoughts at the edge of language and who cast shadows over everything they touch. Many animals have eyes, nostrils, lips, and ears disposed in ways that resemble the disposition of the human face. And many animals recognize each other by their features. But would it be right to say that they have faces and direct their attention to the face when relating to their companions? And what kind of questions are those? Can they be answered by empirical investigation, or are they bound up with ontological distinctions that lie deeper than the study of animal behaviour? In a famous book, from which I've taken an illustration there, Darwin set out to show that the expression of emotion in humans resembles its expression in other animals, and he gave examples that were supposed to show this. The human face, he thought, is distinguished by its mobility, but not by its role in social communication. Emotions and motives are expressed in the face, so enabling other members of the species to anticipate behaviour, whether aggressive, appeasing, amorous, retreating, or alarmed. In this illustration on the screen, you see three pictures of a dog, a swan, and a person. And Darwin argued that these are variations on a single pattern in which the teeth are bared for attack, defences are raised, and vulnerable features withdrawn for protection. Obviously, swans don't have teeth, but nevertheless they have the equivalent in the beak. And the laid-back ears of the dog are there to protect the most vulnerable part of the body, which is where the head and the neck are joined. So the idea is that there is a single posture of aggression common to all animals, and which also manifests itself in the posture, in the face, in the confrontation with others in a similar way. And here's another picture from the same book, in which we see fear and apprehension registered in ways that again have their equivalent in other animals, although I doubt that you'll find a dog or a horse that could manage it. Now, of course, faces, like any other part of the body, can display the forces that act on them. In that sense, they function as what Grice called natural signs in his famous articles on meaning. Grice expressly distinguished such natural signs from the human act of meaning something. Animals can, of course, read natural signs. A horse notices the laid-back ears of his neighbour and gets out of the way. And you, if you're interested in horses, have to recognise what the laid-back ear means. Otherwise, you'll be in trouble too. A dog recognises the submissive gestures of his antagonist and gives up the fight. But this does not mean either that animals can mean things as we mean them, or that they see what we see when we see the expression in a face. We have to ask ourselves what advantage it would be to an animal that it could see faces, as well as the clues to future behaviour that they contain. The face, for us, is an instrument of meaning and communication, and mediates between self and other in ways that are special to itself. Now, animals don't, of course, have the concept of the face, for this is a concept bound up with distinctions that only language users can make. It doesn't follow that they don't recognise faces. After all, no horse has the concept of a horse, but every horse recognises horses and is able to distinguish horse from non-horse in its environment. Animals are also able to discriminate objects on the basis of their gestalt, the overall outline and similarity of form, even when this is not the result of a piecemeal similarity of parts. Birds are very good at this. Nevertheless, when it comes to faces, it seems redundant to describe an animal as recognising something or someone by the face, rather than by the component features, such as nose, brow, eyes, and colouring. Maybe there are people who are like animals in this respect, who are unable to understand faces as faces, but who yet recognise people by their features. Maybe such a person reasons as follows: long ears, wide-set eyes, large lips, high cheekbones, yes, that's Bill. Horses seem to have this capacity, at least when it comes to recognising each other, and so too do cats and dogs. But they do not seem to have the capacity that we have, which is to see Bill in his face, and to see that face as an I and a you. In other words, you could imagine a person being face-blind, as animals are face-blind, even if he is not blind to all the components that make up faces. Maybe the cases of prosopagnosia are like this. The case would resemble what Wittgenstein calls aspect blindness, as when someone who can see everything that composes the image in a picture cannot see the image. And I suspect that tone deaf people are like this. It's an example I took last time, if you remember, the distinction between hearing a melody and hearing a succession of sounds in which it occurs. Tone-deaf people hear all the sounds that compose the musical argument, but cannot grasp the character of the whole, the way in which something begins, continues, and ends through the sequence. Seeing a face as a face means going beyond the physical features in some way to a whole that emerges from them in the way a melody emerges from a sequence of pitched sounds, and which is, as Levinas aptly says, both a visitation and a transcendence. I say aptly, that is the only sentence in Levinas which I've ever understood, so I keep coming back to it. I have an idea of transcendence from my own case. My face is the one part of me that I do not see, unless, that is, I set out to see it by using a mirror. People are surprised by their own face, in the way that they are not surprised by any other part of their body or by the face of another person. It is through the sight of their own face that they have the most vivid sense of what they are for others and what they are as others. In the old story of Narcissus, the protagonist responds to himself as another through confronting his own face in a pool. And because he does not turn away, he is destroyed by what he sees. My face is also the part of me to which others direct their attention whenever they address me as you. I lie behind my face, and yet I am present in it, speaking and looking through it at a world of others who are in turn both revealed and concealed by, like me. Let's have an example. My face is therefore bound up with the pathos of my condition. In a sense, you are always more clearly aware than I can be of what I am in the world. And when I confront my own face, there is a moment of fear as I try to fit the person whom I know so well to this thing that others know better. How can the person whom I know as a continuous unity from my earliest days until now be identical with this decaying flesh that others have addressed through all its changes? This is the question that Rembrandt explored in his lifelong series of self-portraits. And you can see how deep the question became for him. When we speak of the person as lying behind his face, we are speaking figuratively. Obviously, he is not identical with his face, but that does not imply that he's wholly other than his face, still less that he is a clandestine soul hidden within the folds of flesh like a tramp hidden under newspapers. Nevertheless, while the natural signs that dogs read in the features of their conspecifics are transparent effects of the passions that compel them, the face of the human being is not, in the same way, transparent. People can deceive through their faces and can use their faces to shape the world in their own favour. In Macbeth, Duncan regrets having been taken in by the treacherous Thane of Cawdor, Macbeth's predecessor in that title, saying, "There is no art to find the mind's construction in the face," meaning that there is no way you can be instructed to discover what lurks behind a deceiving smile. The play proves Duncan right, since he is at once taken in by Macbeth, who murders him. This possibility of deception arises precisely because we do not make a distinction in our ordinary encounters between a person and his face. When I confront another person face to face, I am not confronting a physical part of him or her, as I am when, for example, I look at the shoulder or the knee. I am confronting him, the individual centre of consciousness, the free being who reveals himself in the face as another I, another like me. There are deceiving faces, but not deceiving hands or knees. When I read a face, I am in some way acquainting myself with the way things seem to another person. And the expression on a face is already a taking responsibility. It is a projection in the world of interpersonal relations of a particular person's being there. To put it in another way, the face is the subject revealing itself in the world of objects. That the face has this character is in part due to the larger significance of the human body. Thanks to our upright posture, our liberated forearms and our all-seizing hands, we are able to face things not merely with our eyes, but with our whole being. This posture penetrates our intentional understanding in subtle ways that have been in part clarified by Merleau-Ponty in his Phenomenology of Perception, and also in a wonderful essay by Erwin Stein in his Phenomenological Psychology. The human face announces the human body and precedes it like an ensign. And our reading of the face reflects this. The face occurs in the world of objects as though lit from behind by a transcendental source. Hence it becomes the target and expression of our interpersonal attitudes. And looks, glances, smiles become the currency of our affections. This means that the human face has a kind of inherent ambiguity. And again, you can see this in the Rembrandt portrait. The face can be seen in two ways, as the vehicle for the subjectivity that shines in it, and as a part of the human anatomy. The tension here comes to the fore in eating, as Leon Kass has shown in his book The Hungry Soul, and Raymond Tallis in his short study of hunger. We do not, as animals do, thrust our mouths into our food in order to ingest it. We lift the food to our mouths while retaining the upright posture that enables us to converse with our neighbours. In all societies, at least prior to the present one, eating is a social occasion with a pronounced ritual character, often preceded by a prayer of thanks. It occurs in a space that has been sanctified and ritualized, and into which the gods have been invited. All rituals impose discipline on the face, and this is part of what we experience when eating. However, the ordered nature of the food-to-face encounter goes beyond ritual discipline. Table manners have the function of maintaining the face and the mouth in their personal, conversational aspect. The well-mannered mouth is not just a mouth, and certainly not an aperture through which food is ingested. It is the place of the voice and the outlet of thought, feeling, and soul. And when people scoff greedily, especially when they do so in the solitary and needy manner that is becoming common, the mouth and the face change aspect to become merely anatomical, their spiritual significance wiped out. Now, of course, there is a balancing act here, and most people fall a little bit short, and indeed must fall short if they are not to appear dreadfully prissy and precious at the dinner table. The crucial point is that even when serving a biological purpose, my face remains under my jurisdiction, so to speak. It's the place where I am and from which I address you. And the face has an interesting repertoire of adjustments, which cannot be understood merely as physical changes of the kind that we observe in the features of other species. For example, there is smiling. Animals do not smile. At best, they grimace in the manner of chimpanzees and bonobos. Milton makes the point in Paradise Lost, writing that smiles from reason flow, to brute denied, and are of love the food. That's a brilliant condensation of a hugely important and far-reaching philosophical thought. The smile that reveals is the involuntary smile, the blessing that one soul confers upon another when shining with the whole self in a moment of self-revelation. And here is, I'm afraid he's gone a bit off the screen, but there is a wonderful involuntary smile which reveals the nature of the soul within. And one should contrast that kind of case with the voluntary and deliberately amplified smile, which is not a smile at all, of course, but a mask. One of the greatest smiles in all painting is that bestowed on Rembrandt by his aged mother. Here the mouth is barely inflected, and the eyes, dull with age, are nevertheless bright with maternal affection. Very few paintings present so vivid an instance of the subject revealed in her face. Smiling is one way of being present in the face. Another way is kissing, which requires orderly jurisdiction, not dissimilar from that required by eating. Describing the temptation and fall of Francesca da Rimini, Dante writes of Francesca recalling the moment when she and Paolo read together the story of Lancelot and Guinevere and reached the passage where Lancelot falls victim to Guinevere's smile. She remembers reading of the smile of Guinevere, rapturously kissed by Lancelot. By a fine transition, she then recalls Paolo kissing not her smile, for she was no longer smiling, but her mouth. And through her mouth, she participates in Paolo's trembling. La bocca mi bacio tutto tremante. And here's a rather nice picture of it by Amos Cassioli, who's a 19th century Italian, where you see exactly what Dante was referring to. The mouth, like the eyes, is a point of intersection of soul and body, person and animal. Francesca has been aware, through Guinevere, of her own smile, since she has been aware of the freedom of choice that is prompting her love. Then Paolo kisses her, and her smile becomes a mouth full of trembling. She attributes this trembling to Paolo, That way, Dante shows the way in which Francesca's self-image has been vanquished. This desire is a force from outside, an overcoming which she is now powerless to resist, since it has been transferred to the I, to the ego. The erotic kiss is not a matter of lips only. Still more are the eyes and the hands involved. And surely Sartre is right to think that in the caress of desire, I am, as he puts it, seeking to incarnate the other. In other words, I'm seeking to bring into the flesh that I touch with my hands or lips the thing that Sartre calls freedom, but which I have called the first-person perspective, which is, again, the subject matter of this painting, obviously. Sartre goes on to argue that sexual desire is inherently paradoxical, since it can succeed in its aim only by possessing another in his freedom. In other words, possessing another's freedom while also removing it. Now, I don't agree with that, but I do think that the kiss of desire brings into prominence the very same ambiguity in the face that is present in eating. The lips offered by one lover to another are replete with subjectivity. They are the avatars of the self, summoning the consciousness of another in a mutual gift. The point is deliciously made by Canova in this famous sculpture of Cupid and Psyche. Can you see? We don't need to pull down the blinds, do we? Are you all happy with the pictures? Yeah? Good. The lips respond as sensory organs, bringing with them all the fatal entrapment of sexual pleasure, and ready to surrender to a force that breaks into the eye from outside. Hence the kiss is the most important moment of desire, the moment in which soul and body are united and in which lovers are fully face to face. The pleasure of the kiss is not a sensory pleasure. It is not a matter of sensations, but of the I-you intentionality and what it means. And for this reason, there can be mistaken kisses and mistaken pleasure in kissing, as was experienced by Lucretia, kissing the man she thought to be her husband, and whom she discovered, too late to defend herself, to be the rapist Tarquin. The presence of the subject in the face is yet more evident in the eyes, and eyes play their part in both smiles and looks. Animals can look at things, they also look at each other, but they do not look into things. Perhaps the most concentrated of all acts of non-verbal communication between people is that of lovers, as in this sculpture, when they look into each other's eyes. They are not looking at the retina or exploring the eye for its anatomical peculiarities as an optician might. So what are they looking at or looking for? The answer is surely obvious. Each is looking for and hoping also to be looking at the other as a free subjectivity who is striving to meet him eye to eye. To turn my eyes to you is a voluntary act, but what I then receive from you is not of my doing. As the symbol of all perception, the eyes come to stand for that epistemic transparency which enables the person to be revealed to another in his embodiment, as we are revealed in our looks, smiles, and blushes. The joining of perspective that is begun when a glance is answered with a blush or a smile finds final realization in wholly reciprocated glances, the me seeing you seeing me of rapt attention, where neither of us can be said to be either doing or suffering what is done. And here is John Donne's description. Our eye beams twisted and did thread our eyes upon one double string, so to entergraft our hands as yet was all the means to make us one, and pictures in our eyes to get was all our propagation. That's a famous poem, The Ecstasy. Looks are voluntary, but the full revelation of the subject in the face is not, as a rule, voluntary. Milton's observation that smiles from reason flow is fully compatible with the fact that smiles are usually involuntary, and gift smiles, that's what one might call them, as I showed in that Tibetan monk, are always so. Likewise, laughter, to be genuine, must be involuntary, even though laughter is something of which only creatures with intentions, reason, and self-consciousness are capable. Now, laughter is a topic in itself, and I must pass over it here, but the same point applies to blushes, which are yet more removed from the realm of choice than laughter is. What Milton says about smiles could equally be said of blushes. Blushes from reason flow, to brute denied, and are of love the food. Only a rational being can blush, even though nobody can blush voluntarily. There are animals with translucent skin, as such as we have, like pigs, but it's not possible for a pig to blush. I who've kept pigs know this not by empirical observation, but by the nature of my relation to the animals. They do flush, though. Their heads can be transformed by a flush of blood from within, but they are not blushing. To decide to blush is impossible. Even if by some trick you are able to make the blood flow into the surface of your cheeks, this would not be blushing, but a kind of deception. And it is the involuntary character of the blush that conveys its meaning. Mary's blush upon meeting John, being involuntary, impresses him with the sense that he has summoned it, that it is in some sense his doing, just as her smile is his doing. Her blush is a fragment of her first-person perspective, called up onto the surface of her being and made visible in her face. In our experience of such things, our sense of the animal unity of the other combines with our sense of his unity as a person, and we perceive those two unities as an indissoluble whole. The subject becomes, then, a real presence in the world of objects. It is, I hope, not too fanciful to extend this phenomenology of the face a little further, and to see the face as a symbol of the individual and a display of his or her individuality. People are individual animals, but they are also individual persons. And as I argued last time, there is a puzzle as to how they can be both. On one tradition, that associated with John Locke, the identity of the person through time is established by the continuity of the eye and not by reference to the constancy of the body. Although I don't accept this, I do accept that identity of the person has something to do with the ability to remember the past and intend the future, while holding oneself accountable for both. And this connection between personal identity and the first-person case has in turn something to do with our sense that human beings are individuals of a special kind, and in a special sense that distinguishes them from other spatio-temporal particulars. The knowledge that I have of my own individuality, which derives from my direct and criterionless awareness of the unity that binds my mental states, gives substance to the view that I am maintained in being as an individual through all conceivable change. The Istigkeit or Heikseitas is exemplified in me as something that I cannot lose. It is prior to all my states and properties and reducible to none of them. In this, I am godlike too, and it is this inner awareness of absolute individuality that is translated into the face and there made flesh. The eyes that look at me are your eyes and also you. The mouth that speaks and cheeks that blush are you. Maybe there is an element of illusion in this sense of absolute individuality. I am inclined to the view that there is no answer to the question, what makes me the individual that I am, that is not a trivial assertion of identity. However, the notion of an absolute individuality arises spontaneously from the most fundamental interpersonal relations. It is implied in all our attempts at integrity and responsible living, and it is built into our way of perceiving as well as our way of describing the human being. Rather than dismiss it as an illusion, I would say that it is a well-founded phenomenon in Leibniz's sense, a way of seeing the world that is indispensable to us and which we could never have conclusive reason to reject. Thus, our interpersonal relations would be inconceivable without the assumption that we can commit ourselves through promises, take responsibility now for some event in the future or the past, make vows that bind us forever to the one who receives them, and undertake obligations that we regard as untransferable to anyone else. And all this we read in the face, and especially in the face of the beloved in the look of love. Our sexual emotions are founded on individualizing thoughts. It is you whom I want and not the type or pattern. This individualizing intentionality does not merely stem from the fact that it is persons, in other words individuals, whom we desire. It stems from the fact that the other is desired as an embodied subject and not as a body. Now, this is a difficult point about sexual desire and controversial theme. Some people disagree with this, but I think you can see the point by drawing a contrast between desire and hunger. Suppose that people were the only edible things, and suppose that they felt no pain on being eaten and were reconstituted at once. How many formalities and apologies would now be required in the satisfaction of hunger? People would try to conceal their appetite and learn not to presume upon the consent of those whom they surveyed with famished glances. It would become a crime to partake of a meal without the meal's consent. Maybe marriage would be the best solution. Still, this predicament is nothing like the predicament in which we are placed by desire. It arises from the lack of anything impersonal to eat, but not from the nature of hunger. Hunger is directed towards the other only as object, and any similar object will serve just as well. It does not individualize the object or propose any other union than that required by need. Still less does it require of the object those intellectual, moral, and spiritual virtues that the lover might reasonably demand, and according to some people must demand, in the object of his desire. When sexual attentions take such a form, they become deeply insulting. And in every form, they compromise not merely the person who addresses them, but also the person addressed. Precisely because desire proposes a relation between subjects, it forces both parties to account for themselves. It is an expression of my freedom which seeks out the freedom in you. Hence, modesty and shame are part of the phenomenon, a recognition that the I is on display in the body and its freedom in jeopardy, so that modesty becomes a bodily attitude. And here is Rembrandt's depiction of that in his painting of Susanna and the Elders. Unwanted advances are therefore also forbidden by the one to whom they might be addressed, and any transgression is felt as a contamination. That is why rape is so serious a crime. It is an invasion of the victim's freedom and a dragging of the subject into the world of things. I don't need to emphasize the extent to which our understanding of desire has been influenced and indeed in part subverted by the literature from Havelock Ellis and Freud right down to the Kinsey reports, which has purported to lift the veil from our collective secrets. But it is worth pointing out that if you describe desire in the terms that have become fashionable as the pursuit of pleasurable sensations in the private parts, then the outrage and pollution of rape become impossible to explain. Rape, on this view, would be every bit as bad as being spat upon, but no worse. In fact, just about everything in human sexual behaviour becomes impossible to explain on what the currently fashionable views, and it is only what might be called the charm of disenchantment that leads people to receive these descriptions as the truth. Sexual desire, then, is inherently compromising, and the choice to express it or to yield to it is an existential choice in which the self is at risk. Not surprisingly, therefore, the sexual act is surrounded by prohibitions. It brings with it a weight of shame, guilt, and jealousy, as well as joy and happiness. Sex is therefore deeply implicated in the sense of original sin, as I described it last time, the sense of being sundered from what we truly are by our fall into the world of objects. There is an important insight contained in the book of Genesis concerning the loss of eros when the body takes over. Adam and Eve have partaken of the forbidden fruit and obtained the knowledge of good and evil. In other words, the ability to invent for themselves the code that governs their behavior. God walks in the garden and they hide, conscious for the first time of their bodies as objects of shame. This shame of the body is an extraordinary feeling and one that no animal could conceivably have. It is a recognition of the body as in some way alien, the thing that has wandered into the world of objects as though of its own accord to become the victim of uninvited glances and desires. Adam and Eve have become conscious that they are not only face to face, but joined in another way as bodies, and the objectifying gaze of lust now poisons their once innocent desire. Milton's description of this transition from the pure eros that preceded the fall to the lust that followed it is one of the great psychological triumphs in English literature. But how brilliantly and succinctly does the author of Genesis cover the same transition? By means of the fig leaf, Adam and Eve are able to rescue each other from the worst, to ensure, however tentatively, that they can still relate to each other face to face and eye to eye, even if the erotic has now been privatized and attached to the private parts. And a couple of illustrations here. This is Rubens showing Adam and Eve at ease with their embodiment. This is before the fall. The fig leaf is there because Rubens was painting after the fall. They're at ease with their embodiment and saying everything through their faces. Adam's urgent and direct is to Eve, hers mysterious and turned away, already ready for temptation. And here's a piece of American evangelical kitsch, which, by giving our parents clothes before the fall, turns their love into a saccharine parody of the erotic. You actually long for the tiger to get to his feet and pounce on him. So I'll go back to Rubens because that's so awful. I have dwelt on the phenomenon of the erotic because it illustrates the importance of the face and what is conveyed by the face in our personal encounters, even in those encounters motivated by what many think to be a desire that we share with other animals and which arises directly from the reproductive strategies of our genes. Now, I've argued at length elsewhere that sexual desire, as we humans experience it, is an interpersonal response, one that presupposes self-consciousness in both subject and object, and which singles out its target as a free and accountable individual, able to give and withhold at will. It has its perverted forms, but it is precisely the interpersonal norm that enables us to describe them as perverted. Sexual relations between members of other species have much in common with those between people, but from the intentional point of view, they are entirely different. Even those creatures who mate for life, like wolves and geese, are not animated by promises given eye to eye, by devotion that shines in the face, or by the desire to unite with the other who is another like me. Not surprisingly, human sexual endeavour is morally weighted, as no animal endeavour can be. And its focus on the individual is mediated by the thought of that individual as a subject who freely chooses, and in whose first-person perspective I appear as he or she appears in mine. Hence there is an important sense in which human sexual desire is non-transferable. To the person wanting Jane, it is absurd to say, take Elizabeth, she will do just as well. For what he wants to do is an action in which Jane is a constituent and not just an instrument. This is not to say that you cannot desire more than one person or move promiscuously from one person to the next. But there is a deep difference between orgiastic sex, in which the other is relevant only as a means, and serial seduction, in which the interpersonal intentionality of desire is maintained in heightened form. Consider Don Giovanni, as we know him. The essence of his personality is seduction, and seducing means eliciting consent through representing your own consuming interest in doing just that. Don Juan is seductive because he feels passion for every woman he meets, and yet his passion is not transferable. It would be absurd to break into his seduction of Zerlina in the brilliant scene in Mozart's opera with the announcement, take this one, she will do just as well, Hence, when Donna Elvira, the Don's wife, actually does interrupt, the scene suddenly becomes intensely pathetic. If we thought of desire merely as a kind of hunger, satisfied now by this human burger, now by that, it would make sense to think of it as transferable. But as I have suggested, even in the pathological cases, like that of Don Juan, it is the interest in the other that is the intentional heart of desire, and in the other as an embodied person with a unique subjectivity that defines his or her point of view. In a once widely read book, Eros and Agape, the Swedish Protestant theologian Anders Nyhrn made a radical distinction between erotic love, which is motivated by its object, and the Christian love recommended by St. Paul in the famous first letter to the Corinthians, chapter 13, which is motivated by God. Greek distinguishes the two as eros and agape, we as romantic love and neighbour love. And a great change came over the world, in Nyhrn's view, when agape replaced eros as the raw material for the love of God. In Plato, eros arises in a godlike way, that is to say, as an external and invading force which overwhelms the psyche. But it ascends like a fire and carries the subject heavenward to the realm of the forms, which is the kingdom of God. St. Paul, by contrast, emphasizes agape, which comes to us from God rather than raising us to him. The downward-turning love of the Almighty fills us with gratitude, and we reciprocate by spreading it outwards to our neighbours here on earth. It would certainly be a mistake to confound eros and agape. Sexual love is not a benefit conferred on the target. As often as not, it is an intolerable affliction. Sexual love desires to possess, and usually to possess exclusively, or at least with an alert distrust of rivals. Sexual love can be cruel and full of anger. It has an ambivalent relation to moral virtue, and in certain forms is inspired and excited by vice. It makes massive and unjust discriminations between the beautiful and the ugly, the strong and the weak, the young and the old. None of those things is true of agape, or charity as it's sometimes called, and no society could be founded on erotic love as a society could be founded on the love of neighbour. Hence, eros is a danger. It is a force that undermines trust as much as it builds trust, and the greatest danger is that it might become detached entirely from interpersonal relations and returned to its animal origins. This is what Plato feared and why he developed his theory of what we now know as Platonic love, maybe the most influential psychological theory in history. For Plato, the physical urge must be overcome so that the desire directed to the beautiful boy can be redirected to its proper object, which is the form of the beautiful itself. Plato's mistake was to think that sexual desire is directed towards the beautiful body rather than towards the embodied subject. The solution to the problem of desire is not to overcome it, but to ensure that it retains its interpersonal character. A society based on agape alone is all very well, but it will not reproduce itself, nor will it produce the crucial relation, that between parent and child, which is the basis on which we can begin to understand our relation to God. Hence, the redemption of the erotic lies at the heart of every viable social order, a fact well understood by traditional religions, all of which see sexual union as a rite of passage in which society as a whole is involved. The face and the smile belong to every kind of human love, to agape as much as to eros. On the Cathedral of Reims, there is affixed the sculpture of an angel. Who relays with his smile the love of God for men. And the sculptor has done his best to represent the kind of existential support that we all receive, on the Christian view, from God. Here we see, incarnate, the essence of love as Aquinas described it, the willing of another's existence. Agape shines an endorsement on its subject, saying that your being is my desire. This is again quite unlike eros, which may equally desire the non-being of its object, just as much as the being, something that surely we didn't need Wagner's Tristan and Isolde to show us. If I feel erotic love for another, I endorse her being for my sake as much as for hers, and the circumstances might arise in which my endorsement is withdrawn. Like Othello, I might, in a passion of jealousy, seek her destruction. If I feel neighbour love for her, then my endorsement is entirely for her sake. It is unconditional in a way that erotic love can never be. Yet more unconditional, of course, is the love that shines in the old face of Rembrandt's mother, who quietly and unassumingly makes a gift of herself to her son. This angel is not making a gift of himself. He is relaying the love of God. And although Christians believe that God also made a gift of himself through Christ, this is a peculiarity of the Christian religion that is not reflected in the account of God's love that we are given in the other Abrahamic faiths. On the Christian understanding, marriage is a sacrament, which means a union forged in the presence of God. And the purpose of the sacrament is to incorporate Eros into the world of agape, to ensure that the face of the lover can still be turned to the world of others. Human societies differ in the way that they manage this, and some don't even attempt it. Some Islamic societies simply hide the face. But the purpose, where it exists, is everywhere the same, to ensure that the private face of the lover can at a moment become the public face of the citizen, or the outgoing face of the friend. And here is a point of great intricacy which I find difficult to express. The Thomistic idea of love as willing the being of another assumes a kind of existential separation between the lover and the beloved. I will your being by willing you to be other than me. In erotic love, however, there is an existential tie. The partners are bound up in each other, as we say, involved. And this is an impediment to the attitude described by St. Thomas. I do not will my lover to be wholly other than me, and I am not happy for him as I am happy for others when they obtain something that they desire. And this is a partial explanation of the fact that I noted earlier that lovers do not look at each other, but look into each other, and search the eyes and face of the beloved for the thing to which they seek to be united, and with which they can never really be united, since it is not a thing, but a perspective, defined for all eternity as other than mine. Now all that is deep and dark, but it goes some way to explaining why it is that the great mystics and religious poets, when they endeavour to describe the love that the soul has for God, almost always follow Plato's example and take erotic love as their analogical base. This is true of St. John of the Cross, St. Teresa of Avila, and I'll give you Bernini's famous tribute to St. Teresa. Of Rumi, Umar Khayyam, George Herbert, and all the rest. For the love of God is also an acknowledgement of total existential dependence, of the nothingness of my being until completed by him. Maybe his love coming down to me and through me to my fellow men is agape, but mine that aspires to him and seeks him out in utter servitude is more like eros, a condition of existential need. In the extreme forms of ecstasy, whether religious or sexual, the face is in fact eclipsed, the self utterly expelled from it, wandering as it were outside the body, and this is what we see in the face of St. Teresa as Bernini depicted her. In conclusion, I want to say something about the destiny of the face in the world that we have entered, a world in which Eros is being rapidly detached from interpersonal commitments and redesigned as a commodity, as a consumer product. What is emerging, it seems to me, is a cult of the body. The face of the model or the pop star is important, but it does not smile a welcome or make a gift of the self within. On the contrary, it wears a tart, repulsing scowl, a withholding of the self for something too precious to share. We're all familiar with this kind of model and this kind of pop group. And the body is put on display as something wholly sexual, whose beauty is quite independent of the face that it supports. Notice how very different this is from Botticelli's famous Venus. I'll give you a few examples we all know that wonderful face, in which the body has no meaning other than the diffusion and outgrowth of the soul that dreams in the face. Anatomically, this body is wholly deformed, and a girl who actually looked like this would have no chance in a modern fashion parade. But Botticelli is presenting us with the true Platonic Eros as he saw it, the face that shines with a light that is not of this world, and which invites us to transcend our appetites and to aspire to that higher realm where we are united to the forms, Plato's version of a world in which the only individuals are souls. Botticelli was a Platonist, of course. Hence, the body of Botticelli's Venus is subservient to the face, a kind of caricature of the female anatomy. The arm, for instance, joined quite at the wrong place, which nevertheless takes its meaning from that holy invitation that we read in the eyes and the lips above. It may be of some interest to contrast Botticelli's Venus with a modern version, an asinine model staring a welcome that belongs to this world. This is an advert for the Venus Hotel in Miami. The underlying tendency of erotic images in our time, I better get out of that one. The underlying tendency of erotic images in our time is to present the body as the focus and meaning of desire, the place where it all occurs in the momentary spasm of sensual pleasure, of which the soul is at best a spectator and no part of the game. In pornography, the face has no role to play other than to be overcome by the bodily frenzy. Kisses are of no significance, and eyes look nowhere since they are searching for nothing beyond the present pleasure. All this amounts to a marginalisation, indeed a kind of desecration of the human face. And this desecration of the face is also a cancelling out of the subject. Sex in the pornographic culture is not a relation between subjects, but a relation between objects. And anything that might enter to impede that conception of the sexual act, the face in particular, must be veiled or spat upon as an unwelcome intrusion of judgment into a sphere where judgment has been forbidden. Now, I don't want to dwell on this, but I'm sure that everyone has had cause to be acquainted with the phenomenon that I've been describing. And I hope that this acquaintance will serve as sufficient proof of my contention that the human face is to be understood in quite another way from the body parts of an animal, that it is the real presence of the subject in the world of objects. Animals do not see faces since they lack the concepts in terms of which eyes, nose, mouth and ears are organized as a face, the concepts of I and you. It is from our experience of the face that we understand our world as illuminated from behind, so to speak, by the lamp of subjectivity. The face is therefore not just an object among objects, and when people invite us to perceive it as such, in the manner of the fashion model and the pop star, they succeed only in defacing the human form. This defacing is something that we witness all around us, and it is also experienced, especially in its sexual application, as a desecration. In my view, it is no accident that we are disposed to speak of desecration when it comes to sex. We can desecrate only what is sacred, and in describing the role of the face in interpersonal relations, I have been taking the first steps towards a theory of the sacred. Levinas writes of the face as the absolute obstacle to murder, the sight of which causes the assassin's hand to drop. Would that Levinas's remark were true, but there is a truth contained in it. Through the face, the subject appears in our world, and he appears there haloed by prohibitions. He is untouchable, inviolable, consecrated. He is not to be treated as an object or to be thrown into the great computer and calculated away. Levinas wrote in torment, thinking of the murder of his own friends and family in the Holocaust. And it is surely an apt description of the genocides of the 20th century that they proceeded as they did only because subjects were first reduced to objects, so that all faces disappeared. That was the work of the concentration camp. And it is a work that has been described for all time by Primo Levi, Solzhenitsyn, and the angelic Nicole Sardanaite, people who kept their faces even in face of the all-defacing machine. Nobody could say that the growth of the pornographic culture is a crime comparable to the crimes described by those writers. Nevertheless, it has moved of its own accord to that first stage on the road to desecration, the stage of objectification, in which the face disappears and the human being disintegrates into an assembly of body parts. My own view is that we should see this as a warning. What to do about it and what it means for us are questions to which I return. But my remarks will only make proper sense, I think, if I move on to consider another kind of face against which the spirit of desecration is currently active, the face of the earth, as we human beings have built it, which will be my topic on Thursday.
Time for some questions.
Decreases of objectification and pornography and podcasts and stuff. But I'm not really sure that that's a sort of the modern trend. I mean, surely prostitution, which is the ultimate sort of modification of the body and sex, has been around
Yes, the temptation in this matter is permanent, obviously. I think in previous societies, it hasn't been the norm through which sex has been represented. Sex has, on the whole, been idealised in its artistic and literary representation, as in this painting, of course. I think we have seen a normalisation of this way of representing the human sexual relations, which is a novelty.
Ezra.
So you said animals don't see faces because they lack the relevant conceptual apparatus. Do you think that babies and very young children see faces?
Well, I think that's a very interesting question. And maybe it's an undecidable one. Babies certainly fix, as we know, the face of the mother very quickly and remain attached to it. Many psychologists have written about this. What is the point at which that face becomes, for the baby, the presence of another like me? You know, Jacques Lacan talks of the mirror stage as in this context. Others recognize that it precedes the emergence of language, but is on the way to the emergence of language always. So I would suggest that this is an intermediate case.
Right at the back.
May I ask about what you make of cultures that promote or institutionalize recovering the face of the baby?
Right. Well, I glancingly mentioned that. I think that in some kind of North African Islamic societies, you get this the use of the burqa as a complete covering of the female face. I think it's meant to represent the fact that that woman is not actually able to appear in public. When she goes out of the house, she's not, as it were, in the public space. She's still in the private space of the home. And that private space is the space of sexual relations. And as it were, she is still a sexual object, even when moving in the street and performing her shopping, whatever it is. And I think that does represent a completely different conception of what man-woman relations are from the one which is normal among us. And we expect women to have the public side that men have just as much as the private side, and to show their face in the street. And showing the face, of course, is a way of declaring that you are open to encounters of a certain kind, at least, yourself a fully accountable member of the public arena.
You don't see it as the objectifying.
Well, it's a very difficult question whether it is objectifying. Some people would say that it's because it's removing, as you say, removing the face, it's removing the subjectivity of the woman. But presumably, the veil can be the burqa can be taken off at a certain stage. But it is certainly a way of saying that this subjectivity can only exist in the domestic arena and not in the public one.
Tim Chappell.
Two bits of evidence for your general argument and a question. First piece of evidence, one of the most powerful experiences I've ever had was when my wife had just given birth to our first child. Because my wife has been sitting down not giving birth, I was having a child. And what a newborn baby does is that its eyes lock onto yours. And it's impossible to look at anything else in the room. So I'm aware there's a biological explanation for this, but you can put this in your terms, I think, as the case where the child, the first thing it does is it inaugurates itself as a person precisely by the use of its face. That's the first piece of it. Second, I wonder what you make of the use of the veil, not just for Muslim women, but in the marriage service. And the other question I wanted to ask has gone for me now, so that's just a question.
Well, that connects obviously with what the gentleman at the back was asking about, the use of the veil. I think the use of the veil, the use of masks, the balmaski, all that sort of thing, these are very important human inventions which have a huge significance. Anything that we do to the face has a huge significance because it can be construed as a withdrawing of the self. The veil in the marriage ceremony, if in those ceremonies in which it occurs, at least, it is there to privatise and to say that this woman is making a gift of herself, but only for this one man. Masked balls are very interesting. Example of the Venetian carnival and so on. It was designed as a kind of liberation from the constraints that normally attach themselves to sexual relations, namely that they are necessarily relations between subjects. If you're wearing a mask and you don't know who the other is and you're not looking into the other's eyes directly, then of course something has changed. And this is is perhaps a move towards that kind of objectification that the first question was referring to. And of course many people thought that of Venetian society as launched in on the path of the devil because of the masked ball.
What did that masking bring
it? Well, masks in the theatre, it's a really interesting thing. Or even more important, the examples that we still know, like the Japanese theatre, the No theatre, and also Kabuki, the mask is very important precisely because it compels the audience to see the expression on the face without allowing the actor to produce it. So the expression that you read on the mask, you read because of the words that are being said. And the mask has to be so designed that it can take all these expressions which are projected onto from the audience. And this is why to make a mask for the No Theatre, you have to belong to a family that has been doing this for generations and generations. And each mask might take 5 years to make. And I think it's a very extremely interesting case because it actually does bring very much to the fore the fact that we see faces in a completely different way. We read into them the subjectivity of the person.
Any further questions?
Would you suggest you prefer the values of old Western Europe to the values we have now?
Am I a reactionary throwback? Yeah. Well, the answer is yes. I have, like everybody, I'm sure I would see the upside as well as the downside of all the things that have happened. I'm concerned like, I think I'm not alone in being concerned about what's happening to sex in the modern world when it is being increasingly made into a consumer product. I think you don't have to be a throwback to feel that there's something that might be wrong here in that sort of thing. But the main question that I think that confronts everybody today is not how we would revive the old forms of marriage and lifelong commitment and so on, but how you can reconcile the new forms of relationship with genuine respect for the human person and the kind of commitments on which humans' happiness in the end depends. And that's a very difficult question which I can't answer.
Be thought that maybe these new hypersexualization of society could end up with happier people.
It might, but you have to remember that first of all that the majority of people are not attractive, and also that everybody is only young for a very short time. You know, if you add these two together, you realise that one might be in danger of creating a society which only about 1% can enjoy.
Perhaps we should stop there.